is the price of any contradiction. It is the victims who made injustice possible. It is the men of reason who made it possible for the rule of the brute to work. The despoiling of reason has been the motive of every anti-reason creed on earth. The despoiling of ability has been the purpose of every creed that preached self-sacrifice. The despoilers have always known it. We haven't. The time has come for us to see. What we are now asked to worship, what had once been dressed as God or King, is the naked, twisted, mindless figure of the human incompetent. This is the new ideal, the goal to aim at, the purpose to live for. And all men are to be rewarded according to how close they approach it. This is the age of the common man, they tell us, a title which any man may claim to the extent of such distinction as he has managed not to achieve. He will rise to a rank of nobility by means of the effort he has failed to make. He will be honored for such virtue as he has not displayed, and he will be paid for the goods which he did not produce. But we who must atone for the guilt of ability, we will work to support him as he orders, with his pleasure as our only reward. Since we have the most to contribute, we will have the least to say. Since we have the better capacity to think, we will not be permitted a thought of our own. Since we have the judgment to act, we will not be permitted an action of our choice. We will work under directives and controls issued by those who are incapable of working. They will dispose of our energy, because they have none to offer, and of our product, because they can't produce. Do you say that this is impossible? That it cannot be made to work? They know it, but it is you who don't. And they are counting on you not to know it. They are counting on you to go on, to work to the limit of the inhuman, and to feed them while you last. And when you collapse, there will be another victim starting out and feeding them while struggling to survive. And the span of each succeeding victim will be shorter, and while you'll die to leave them a railroad, your last descendant in spirit will die to leave them a loaf of bread. This does not worry the looters of the moment. Their plan, like all the plans of all the royal looters of the past, is only that the loot shall last their lifetime. It has always lasted before, because in one generation they could not run out of victims. But this time, it will not last. The victims are on strike. We are on strike against martyrdom and against the moral code that demands it. We are on strike against those who believe that one man must exist for the sake of another. We are on strike against the morality of cannibals, be it practiced in body or in spirit. We will not deal with men on any terms but ours, and our terms are a moral code which holds that man is an end in himself and not the means to any end of others. We do not seek to force our code upon them. They are free to believe what they please, but for once they will have to believe it and to exist without our help. And once and for all, they will learn the meaning of their creed. That creed has lasted for centuries, solely by the sanction of the victims, by means of the victims' acceptance of punishment for breaking a code impossible to practice. But that code was intended to be broken. It is a code that thrives not on those who observe it, but on those who don't. A morality kept in existence not by virtue of its saints, but by the grace of its sinners. We have decided not to be sinners any longer. We have ceased breaking that moral code. We shall blast it out of existence forever by the one method that it can't withstand, by obeying it. We are obeying it. We are complying. In dealing with our fellow men, we are observing their code of values to the letter and sparing them all the evils they denounce. The mind is evil. We have withdrawn the works of our minds from society, and not a single idea of ours is to be known or used by men. Ability is a selfish evil that leaves no chance to those who are less able. We have withdrawn from the competition and left all chances open to incompetence. The pursuit of wealth is greed, the root of all evil. We do not seek to make fortunes any longer. It is evil to earn more than one's bare sustenance. We take nothing but the lowliest jobs, and we produce by the effort of our muscles no more than we consume for our immediate needs, and not a penny, nor an inventive thought left over to harm the world. It is evil to succeed, since success is made by the strong at the expense of the weak. We have ceased burdening the weak with our ambition, and have left them free to prosper without us. It is evil to be an employer. We have no employment to offer. It is evil to own property. We own nothing. It is evil to enjoy one's existence in this world. There is no form of enjoyment that we seek from their world. And this was hardest for us to attain. What we now feel for their world is that emotion which they preach as an ideal. Indifference, the blank, the zero, the mark of death. We are giving men everything they've professed to want and to seek as virtue for centuries. Now let them see whether they want it. It was you who started this strike? She asked. I did. He got up. He stood, hands in pockets, his face in the light. And she saw him smile with the easy, effortless, implacable amusement of certainty. We've heard so much about strikes, he said, and about the dependence of the uncommon man upon the common. We've heard it shouted that the industrialist is a parasite, that his workers support him, create his wealth, make his luxury possible. And what would happen to him if they walked out? Very well, I propose to show to the world who depends on whom, who supports whom, who is the source of wealth, who makes whose livelihood possible, and what happens to whom when who walks out. The windows were now sheets of darkness, reflecting the dots of lighted cigarettes. He picked a cigarette from a table beside him, and in the flare of a match, she saw the brief sparkle of gold, the dollar sign between his fingers. I quit and joined him and went on strike, said Hugh Axton, because I could not share my profession with men who claim that the qualification of an intellectual consists of denying the existence of the intellect. People would not employ a plumber who'd attempt to prove his professional excellence by asserting that there's no such thing as plumbing, but apparently the same standards of caution are not considered necessary in regard to philosophers. I learned from my own pupil, however, that it was I who made this possible. When thinkers accept those who deny the existence of thinking as fellow thinkers of a different school of thought, it is they who achieve the destruction of the mind. They grant the enemy's basic premise, thus granting the sanction of reason to formal dementia. A basic premise is an absolute that permits no cooperation with its antithesis and tolerates no tolerance. In the same manner, and for the same reason, as a banker may not accept and pass counterfeit money, granting it the sanction, honor, and prestige of his bank, just as he may not grant the counterfeiter's demand for tolerance of a mere difference of opinion, so I may not grant the title of philosopher to Dr. Simon Pritchett, or compete with him for the minds of men. Dr. Pritchett has nothing to deposit to the account of philosophy, except his declared intention to destroy it. He seeks to cash in, by means of denying it, on the power of reason among men. He seeks to stamp the mint mark of reason upon the plans of his looting masters. He seeks to use the prestige of philosophy to purchase the enslavement of thought. But that prestige is an account which can exist only so long as I am there to sign the checks. Let him do it without me. Let him and those who entrust to him their children's minds have exactly that which they demand, a world of intellectuals without intellect and of thinkers who proclaim that they cannot think. I am conceding it. I am complying. And when they see the absolute reality of their non-absolute world, I will not be there, and it will not be I who will pay the price of their contradiction. Dr. Axton quit on the principle of sound banking, said Midas Mulligan. I quit on the principle of love. Love is the ultimate form of recognition one grants to superlative values. It was the Hunsacker case that made me quit, that case when a court of law ordered that I honor as first right to my depositors' funds the demand of those who would offer proof that they had no right to demand it. I was ordered to hand out money earned by men to a worthless rotter whose only claim consisted of his inability to earn it. I was born on a farm. I knew the meaning of money. I'd dealt with many men in my life. I'd watched them grow. I'd made my fortune by being able to spot a certain kind of man, the kind who never asked you for faith, hope, and charity, but offered you facts, proof, and profit. Did you know that I invested in Hank Reardon's business at the time when he was rising, when he had just beaten his way out of Minnesota to buy the steel mills in Pennsylvania? Well, when I looked at that court order on my desk, I had a vision. I saw a picture, and I saw it so clearly that it changed the looks of everything for me. I saw the bright face and the eyes of young Reardon, as he'd been when I'd met him first. I saw him lying at the foot of an altar with his blood running down into the earth. And what stood on that altar was Lee Hunsacker, with the mucus-filled eyes whining that he'd never had a chance. It's strange how simple things become once you see them clearly. It wasn't hard for me to close that bank and go. I kept seeing for the first time in my life what it was that I'd lived for and loved. She looked at Judge Narragansett.
You quit over the same case, didn't you?
Yes, said Judge Narragansett. I quit when the Court of Appeals reversed my ruling. The purpose for which I'd chosen my work was my resolve to be a guardian of justice. But the laws they asked me to enforce made me the executor of the vilest injustice conceivable. I was asked to use force to violate the rights of disarmed men who came before me to seek my protection for their rights. Litigants obey the verdict of a tribunal solely on the premise that there is an objective rule of conduct which they both accept. Now I saw that one man was to be bound by it, but the other was not. One was to obey a rule, the other was to assert an arbitrary wish, his need. And the law was to stand on the side of the wish. Justice was to consist of upholding the unjustifiable. I quit, because I could not have borne to hear the words Your Honor addressed to me by an honest man. Her eyes moved slowly to Richard Halley, as if she were both pleading and afraid to hear his story. He smiled. I would have forgiven men for my struggle, said Richard Halley. It was their view of my success that I could not forgive. I had felt no hatred in all the years when they rejected me. If my work was new, I had to give them time to learn. If I took pride in being first to break a trail to a height of my own, I had no right to complain if others were slow to follow. That was what I had told myself through all those years. Except on some nights when I could neither wait nor believe any longer, when I cried, Why? But found no answer. Then, on the night when they chose to cheer me, I stood before them on the stage of a theater, thinking that this was the moment I had struggled to reach, wishing to feel it, but feeling nothing. I was seeing all the other knights behind me, hearing the why, which still had no answer, and their cheers seemed as empty as their snubs. If they had said, Sorry to be so late, thank you for waiting, I would have asked for nothing else, and they could have had anything I had to give them. But what I saw in their faces and in the way they spoke when they crowded to praise me was the thing I had heard being preached to artists, only I had never believed that anyone human could mean it. They seemed to say that they owed me nothing, that their deafness had provided me with a moral goal, that it had been my duty to struggle, to suffer, to bear for their sake whatever sneers, contempt, injustice, torture they chose to inflict upon me, to bear it in order to teach them to enjoy my work, that this was their rightful due and my proper purpose. And then I understood the nature of the looter in spirit, a thing I had never been able to conceive. I saw them reaching into my soul, just as they reach into Mulligan's pocket, reaching to expropriate the value of my person, just as they reach to expropriate his wealth. I saw the impertinent malice of mediocrity, boastfully holding up its own emptiness as an abyss to be filled by the bodies of its betters. I saw them seeking, just as they seek, to feed on Mulligan's money, to feed on those hours when I wrote my music, and on that which made me write it, seeking to gnaw their way to self-esteem by extorting from me the admission that they were the goal of my music, so that precisely by reason of my achievement, it would not be they who'd acknowledge my value, but I who would bow to theirs. It was that night that I took the oath never to let them hear another note of mine. The streets were empty when I left that theater. I was the last one to leave. And I saw a man whom I'd never seen before waiting for me in the light of a lamp post. He did not have to tell me much, but the concerto I dedicated to him is called the Concerto of Deliverance. She looked at the others. Please tell me your reasons, she said, with a faint stress of firmness in her voice, as if she were taking a beating but wished to take it to the end.
I quit when medicine was placed under state control some years ago, said Dr. Hendricks. Do you know what it takes to perform a brain operation? Do you know the kind of skill it demands and the years of passionate, merciless, excruciating devotion that go to acquire that skill? That was what I would not place at the disposal of men whose sole qualification to rule me was their capacity to spout the fraudulent generalities that got them elected to the privilege of enforcing their wishes at the point of a gun. I would not let them dictate the purpose for which my years of study had been spent, or the conditions of my work, or my choice of patients, or the amount of my reward. I observed that in all the discussions that preceded the enslavement of medicine, men discussed everything except the desires of the doctors. Men considered only the welfare of the patients, with no thought for those who were to provide it. That a doctor should have any right, desire, or choice in the matter was regarded as irrelevant selfishness. His is not to choose, they said, only to serve. That a man who's willing to work under compulsion is too dangerous a brute to entrust with a job in the stockyards never occurred to those who proposed to help the sick by making life impossible for the healthy. I've often wondered at the smugness with which people assert their right to enslave me, to control my work, to force my will, to violate my conscience, to stifle my mind. Yet what is it that they expect to depend on when they lie on an operating table under my hands? Their moral code has taught them to believe that it is safe to rely on the virtue of their victims. Well, that is the virtue I have withdrawn. Let them discover the kind of doctors that their system will now produce. Let them discover in their operating rooms and hospital wards that it is not safe to place their lives in the hands of a man whose life they have throttled. It is not safe if he is the sort of man who resents it, and still less safe if he is the sort who doesn't.
I quit, said Ellis Wyatt, because I didn't wish to serve as the cannibal's meal and to do the cooking besides. I discovered, said Ken Daneker, that the men I was fighting were impotent. The shiftless, the purposeless, the irresponsible, the irrational. It was not I who needed them. It was not theirs to dictate terms to me. It was not mine to obey demands. I quit to let them discover it, too. I quit, said Quentin Daniels, because if there are degrees of damnation, the scientist who places his mind in the service of brute force is the longest-range murderer on Earth. They were silent. She turned to Galt. And you? She asked. You were first. What made you come to it? He chuckled. My refusal to be born with any original sin.
What do you mean?
I have never felt guilty of my ability. I've never felt guilty of my mind. I have never felt guilty of being a man. I accepted no unearned guilt, and thus was free to earn and to know my own value. Ever since I can remember, I'd felt that I would kill the man who'd claim that I exist for the sake of his need, and I had known that this was the highest moral feeling. That night at the 20th Century meeting, when I heard an unspeakable evil being spoken in a tone of moral righteousness, I saw the root of the world's tragedy, the key to it, and the solution. I saw what had to be done. I went out to do it.
And the motor? She asked. Why did you abandon it? Why did you leave it to the Starnes heirs?
It was their father's property. He paid me for it. It was made on his time. But I knew that it would be of no benefit to them, and that no one would ever hear of it again. It was my first experimental model. Nobody but me or my equivalent could have been able to complete it or even to grasp what it was. And I knew that no equivalent of mine would come near that factory from then on.
You knew the kind of achievement your motor represented?
Yes.
And you knew you were leaving it to perish?
Yes. He looked off into the darkness beyond the windows and chuckled softly. But it was not a sound of amusement. I looked at my motor for the last time before I left. I thought of the men who claim that wealth is a matter of natural resources, and of the men who claim that wealth is a matter of seizing the factories, and of the men who claim that machines condition their brains. Well, there was the motor to condition them, and there it remained as just exactly what it is without man's mind, as a pile of metal scraps and wires going to rust. You have been thinking of the great service which that motor could have rendered to mankind if it had been put into production. I think that on the day when men understand the meaning of its fate in that factory's junk heap, it will have rendered a greater one.
Did you expect to see that day when you left it?
No.
Did you expect a chance to rebuild it elsewhere?
No.
And you were willing to let it remain in a junk heap?
For the sake of what that motor meant to me, he said slowly. I had to be willing to let it crumble and vanish forever. He looked straight at her, and she heard the steady, unhesitant, uninflected ruthlessness of his voice. Just as you will have to be willing to let the rail of Taggart Transcontinental crumble and vanish. She held his eyes. Her head was lifted, and she said softly in the tone of a proudly open plea,
Don't make me answer you now.
I won't. We'll tell you whatever you wish to know. We won't urge you to make a decision. He added, and she was shocked by the sudden gentleness of his voice, I said that that kind of indifference toward a world which should have been ours was the hardest thing to attain. I know. We've all gone through it.
She looked at the quiet, impregnable room and at the light that came from his motor, on the faces of men who were the most serene and confident gathering she had ever attended.
"What did you do when you walked out of the 20th century?" she asked.
"I went out to become a flame spotter. I made it my job to watch for those bright flares in the growing night of savagery, which were the men of ability, the men of the mind, to watch their course, their struggle, and their agony, and to pull them out when I knew that they had seen enough."
"What did you tell them to make them abandon everything?"
"I told them that they were right."
In answer to the silent question of her glance, he added, "I gave them the pride they did not know they had. I gave them the words to identify it. I gave them that priceless possession which they had missed, had longed for, yet had not known they needed, a moral sanction. Did you call me the destroyer and the hunter of men? I was the walking delegate of this strike, the leader of the victims' rebellion, the defender of the oppressed, the disinherited, the exploited. And when I use these words, they have for once a literal meaning."
"Who were the first to follow you?"
He let a moment pass in deliberate emphasis, then answered, "My two best friends. You know one of them. You know perhaps better than anyone else what price he paid for it. Our own teacher, Dr. Axton, was next. He joined us within one evening's conversation. William Hastings, who had been my boss in the research laboratory of 20th Century Motors, had a hard time fighting it out with himself. It took him a year, but he joined. Then Richard Halley, then Midas Mulligan."
"Who took 15 minutes, said Mulligan.
She turned to him.
"It was you who established this valley?"
"Yes," said Mulligan.
"It was just my own private retreat at first. I bought it years ago. I bought miles of these mountains, section by section, from ranchers and cattlemen who didn't know what they owned. The valley is not listed on any map. I built this house when I decided to quit. I cut off all possible avenues of approach except one road, and its camouflage beyond anyone's power to discover. And I stocked this place to be self-supporting so that I could live here for the rest of my life and never have to see the face of a looter. When I heard that John had got Judge Narragansett, too, I invited the judge to come here. Then we asked Richard Halley to join us. The others remained outside at first."
"We had no rules of any kind," said Galt, "except one. When a man took our oath, it meant a single commitment, not to work in his own profession, not to give to the world the benefit of his mind. Each of us carried it out in any manner he chose. Those who had money retired to live on their savings. Those who had to work took the lowest jobs they could find. Some of us had been famous. Others, like that young brakeman of yours whom Halley discovered, were stopped by us before they had set out to get tortured. But we did not give up our minds or the work we loved. Each of us continued in his real profession in whatever manner and spare time he could manage, but he did it secretly for his own sole benefit, giving nothing to men, sharing nothing. We were scattered all over the country, as the outcasts we had always been. Only now we accepted our parts with conscious intention. Our sole relief were the rare occasions when we could see one another. We found that we liked to meet, in order to be reminded that human beings still existed. So we came to set aside 1 month a year to spend in this valley, to rest, to live in a rational world, to bring our real work out of hiding, to trade our achievements. Here, where achievements meant payment, not expropriation. Each of us built his own house here, at his own expense, for 1 month of life out of 12. It made the 11 easier to bear."
"You see, Miss Taggart," said Hugh Axton, "man is a social being, but not in the way the looters preach."
"It's the destruction of Colorado that started the growth of this valley," said Midas Mulligan. "Ellis White and the others came to live here permanently because they had to hide. Whatever part of their wealth they could salvage, they converted into gold or machines, as I had, and they brought it here. There were enough of us to develop the place and to create jobs for those who had had to earn their living outside. We have now reached the stage where most of us can live here full-time. The valley is almost self-supporting. And as to the goods that we can't yet produce, I purchased them from the outside through a pipeline of my own. It's a special agent, a man who does not let my money reach the looters. We are not a state here, not a society of any kind. We're just a voluntary association of men held together by nothing but every man's self-interest. I own the valley, and I sell the land to the others when they want it. Judge Narragansett is to act as our arbiter in case of disagreements. He hasn't had to be called upon as yet. They say that it's hard for men to agree.
You'd be surprised how easy it is, when both parties hold as their moral absolute that neither exists for the sake of the other, and that reason is their only means of trade. The time is approaching when all of us will have to be called to live here, because the world is falling apart so fast that it will soon be starving. But we will be able to support ourselves in this valley.
The world is crashing faster than we expected, said Hugh Axton. Men are stopping and giving up. Your frozen trains, the gangs of raiders, the deserters, they're men who've never heard of us, and they're not part of our strike. They are acting on their own. It's the natural response of whatever rationality is still left in them. It's the same kind of protest as ours.
We started with no time limit in view, said Galt. We did not know whether we'd live to see the liberation of the world, or whether we'd have to leave our battle and our secret to the next generations. We knew only that this was the only way we cared to live. But now we think that we will see, and soon, the day of our victory and of our return.
When? She whispered.
When the code of the looters has collapsed. He saw her looking at him, her glance half question, half hope, and he added, When the creed of self-immolation has run for once its undisguised course, when men find no victims ready to obstruct the path of justice and to deflect the fall of retribution on themselves, when the preachers of self-sacrifice discover that those who are willing to practice it have nothing to sacrifice, and those who have are not willing any longer, when men see that neither their hearts nor their muscles can save them, but the mind they damned is not there to answer their screams for help, when they collapse, as they must, as men without mind, when they have no pretense of authority left, no remnant of law, no trace of morality, no hope, no food, and no way to obtain it, when they collapse and the road is clear, then we'll come back to rebuild the world. The Taggart terminal, she thought. She heard the words beating through the numbness of her mind as the sum of a burden she had not had time to weigh. This was the Taggart terminal, she thought. This room, not the giant concourse in New York. This was her goal, the end of track, the point beyond the curve of the earth where the two straight lines of rail met and vanished, drawing her forward, as they had drawn Nathaniel Taggart. This was the goal Nathaniel Taggart had seen in the distance, and this was the point still holding the straight-line glance of his lifted head above the spiral motion of men in the granite concourse. It was for the sake of this that she had dedicated herself to the rail of Taggart Transcontinental, as to the body of a spirit yet to be found. She had found it. Everything she had ever wanted, it was here in this room, reached, and hers. But the price was that net of rail behind her, the rail that would vanish, the bridges that would crumble, the signal lights that would go out. And yet, everything I had ever wanted, she thought, looking away from the figure of a man with sun-colored hair and implacable eyes.
You don't have to answer us now.
She raised her head. He was watching her as if he had followed the steps in her mind.
We never demand agreement, he said. We never tell anyone more than he is ready to hear. You were the first person who has learned our secret ahead of time, but you're here, then you had to know. Now you know the exact nature of the choice you'll have to make. If it seems hard, it's because you still think that it does not have to be one or the other. You will learn that it does.
Will you give me time?
Your time is not ours to give. Take your time. You alone can decide what you'll choose to do and when. We know the cost of that decision. We've paid it. That you've come here might now make it easier for you. Or harder.
Harder, she whispered.
I know.
He said it, his voice as low as hers, with the same sound of being forced past one's breath. And she missed an instant of time, as in the stillness after a blow, because she felt that this, not the moments when he had carried her in his arms down the mountainside, but this meeting of their voices, had been the closest physical contact between them. A full moon stood in the sky above the valley when they drove back to his house. It stood like a flat, round lantern without rays, with a haze of light hanging in space, not reaching the ground, and the illumination seemed to come from the abnormal white brightness of the soil. In the unnatural stillness of sight, without color,
The earth seemed veiled by a film of distance. Its shapes did not merge into a landscape, but went slowly flowing past, like the print of a photograph on a cloud. She noticed suddenly that she was smiling. She was looking down at the houses of the valley. Their lighted windows were dimmed by a bluish cast. The outlines of their walls were dissolving. Long bands of mist were coiling among them in torpid, unhurried waves. It looked like a city sinking under water. "What do they call this place?" she asked. "I call it Mulligan's Valley," he said. "The others call it Galt's Gulch." "I'd call it..."